This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts voters will weigh in on 4 ballot questions at the polls this fall, and sometimes it's hard to kind of break through the noise and fully understand what's at stake.
In Massachusetts, working people pay a higher share of taxes than the wealthiest 1%. It's true. They pay less and we pay more.
Politicians are pushing a tax hike on the November ballot. That makes no sense.
Our state already has the biggest budget surplus in history.
So the sound there is from ads for both the yes and no sides of question 1, which deals with the Fair Share Amendment, sometimes known as the millionaire's tax. Right now, income tax in Massachusetts is a flat rate, 5%. No matter how much you make, the percentage stays the same. Question 1 could potentially change that by adding a new 4% tax on any income over $1 million. So essentially, any additional income beyond the first million a person made would be taxed at 9%. And the money raised through that tax would be earmarked for education, bridges, roads, and public transportation. To get a sense of what the tax could mean for the state, both good and bad, we sat down with Evan Horowitz, who's executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis. The center recently conducted research on all 4 ballot questions and published its results. And when we sat down, we started by asking Evan, how is it possible, according to the center's research, that a tax would only impact 0.6% of Massachusetts households, but could possibly raise $1.3 billion, as the center has concluded?
0.6% is a small number, right? You know, there are 3 million households in the state and something, or 3 to 4 million households, and something like 26,000 of them in any given year will end up paying this tax. That's a teeny number. And I think you might ask how you could imagine raising a substantial amount of revenue from such a teeny number of households. And the answer is that those 0.6% of households earns almost a quarter of all income in the state. So 0.6% of households earn between 20 and 25% of all the income earned by anybody in the state. And it's because of that inequality that this tax can raise any money at all from such a small pool of payers.
So there is concern, Evan, about 2 types of person who may not typically represent that 0.6%, also sometimes known in debates as sort of the 1%, right? And one is a small business owner. And there's concern that this extra 4%, again, so the first $1 million regular tax rate, we're talking about 4% for dollars earned over $1 million. Talk us through what the concern with small businesses is.
So here's the thing. It's easy to get in your head that the people earning over $1 million a year are just super rich people who always earn over $1 million a year. They did it last year, they'll do it next year. But that's not actually who the tax will hit. We estimate about half of the people are one-time millionaires. So in any given year, about half the people who earn over $1 million, they're just earning it once in their whole lives and never again. So they'll pay this tax in 1 year and never again. And for those people, you should really think about people who are maybe selling their business. Right? It's not that their business generates $1 million for them every year, but you know, they're a dentist and you've built up a practice, you know, over 3 decades. And you're ready to retire and you decide you're going to sell off the business. You're going to sell off, you know, your equipment or your client list, whatever it is. And in that year, you sell this business, you may make income of $4, $5, $6 million and you'll pay the tax in that year. So I think in terms of hitting business owners, that's how you have to think about it. It's businesses at the point of sale, at the end of one owner's control of a business. And so in that year, they may pay. Having said that, in that year, they'll pay because they will have a giant windfall. The other sort of group of people that will pay kind of one time are those who have an investment. You know, maybe you bought some Apple stock in the 70s or something. You've been holding on to it. It's your nest egg. And then you're ready to retire and it's worth $2 million. And you'll pay it in that year. But again, because you're earning over $1 million.
What about a house?
Very rare. It's extremely rare. It'll happen. But remember, it's not whether you sell the house for over $1 million. It's whether you have capital gains on the house over $1 million.
Meaning whether you make $1 million on the sale.
And it's actually even harder than that, because with houses, you get a big deduction. So some of the gains don't count. And you get to, like, if you update your kitchen, you get to deduct that. So it's very, very rare for people who sell houses to be subject to this.
So it's likely that the property value would have to be lots over $1 million.
Exactly. Many multiples.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So this is a key thing then, and I think it's kind of hitting me now. We have this kind of cultural understanding of a millionaire, and I'm using air quotes here.
It's hard to see on the radio. Yeah. When you do that, but it's good to call it out.
I can't hear them either, so I'm doing them at the microphone. And this cultural understanding is the millionaire means you've got a lot of money over $1 million. You're worth millions all the time. But that's a bit of a misnomer here, because what we're really talking about here is if in a given year you, for any number of reasons, have income more than $1 million, then you get taxed on this.
That's right. That's right.
And it's still very small percentage, 0.6% of households.
Oh, it's teeny.
People.
You know, some of the... A big chunk of it will be paid by people who earn over $5 million, you know. So even if there are businesses, maybe you owe a little bit of money. You said you earn $1 million and $1, you pay an extra 4 cents, right? Nobody cares about 4 cents. But you earn an extra $1 million, you pay $40,000. But it's people who earn in a given year $10 million. That's where a lot of the money is actually coming from. And those people do tend to be the kind of more consistent millionaires rather than the one-timers.
And I do want to go back. So we've been doing the money stuff. Last thing, 0.6%. I do want to be really clean on this. That is actually... households is
it's
that point.
Actually, tax filers, but yes.
Tax
it's something
filers.
Like households.
Okay.
I know. If you want to be really, really clean, then I have to get technical. But yeah, it's not people. It's something closer to households.
Something closer to households. Okay. So now you had laid out earlier, all right, well, there's the money and then there's the earmarking. So go back, remind us what question one, and we're talking with Evan Horowitz here. He's the executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis, about question one. Remind us about this money is targeted for X.
Yeah, because the idea behind this ballot question was never just like, hey, we should tax super rich people. It was we could use money to pay for things we care about in the state, like public education, like transit transportation. And one good way, at least if you're a proponent, one good way to do this is by taxing rich people because of the degree of inequality in the state. So, I mean, that's always been kind of the theory behind it. And so it's written right into the constitutional amendment that the money raised by this tax has to be spent on public education, transit, transportation.
So those for it would say, see, we have carved out what it can be used for things that we know, A, we know we need for the state, and B, that justify creating this extra tax. The opponents would say that does not, what's the word I'm looking for, create enough beholdenness, which is not a word,
I know what
for
you mean.
The state legislature. It's not specific enough, and they could still do lots of things that wouldn't be the reason you said as a voter, yes, I'm willing to do this.
And the opponents are right in the sense that just because you say this money has to be spent in those areas doesn't mean that those areas will get additional spending. The clearest way to say this is to say, okay, let's say we were planning for 2023 as a state to spend $5 billion on K-12 schools. I'm making this number up, but let's say we're going to do that. And this millionaire's tax passes. So we have an additional $1 billion. And that has to go, let's say, it has to go to schools. It doesn't, but let's say it did. So then you'd think, oh, $6 billion for schools. But that's no guarantee. Legislators could turn around and say,
right?
Oh, we'll use that billion from the millionaire's tax, but we'll take a different billion and we'll spend it somewhere else. So you can't really guarantee you're going to see additional spending. Having said that, we've looked into this because just because you can't guarantee it doesn't mean it won't happen. And looking back at other kind of earmarked similar cases, it does seem like kind of roughly half of this money will lead to additional spending in the targeted areas.
Okay. So basically, based on your research, around 50% we can be fairly certain will go to the areas that it was targeted to. And 50% is a bit of a wild card. Might not, and this is based on past spending patterns.
That's right. And we actually said so between 30 and 70%. There's a lot of variation here in terms of how money has been spent in other kind of similar cases. But I think the kind of all or nothing framing of the debate is really missing the point. It's likely to be in the middle. And the reason it's likely to be in the middle is not because legislators have to spend the money on these areas by some constitutional decree. It's because these are the areas they want to spend money on. Like, there's a reason that the constitutional amendment singles out these areas. They are high priority areas. So with additional money, some of it is likely to go to high priority areas. And if there's additional money that doesn't go there, so let's say some leaks out, that doesn't mean it's going to get wasted. It's just going to go to other priorities, right? It'll get repurposed for, it could be environmental spending. It could be spending for DCF. It could be spending for tax cuts. It could be a variety of things, but it will be based on the priorities legislators have at that moment.
Okay. So there are two other kind of we have this other bucket sort of intended and unintended consequences. And I have two more things I kind of want to hit in that bucket with you. The first is the argument that what it may do is drive people out of our tax base that we want in our tax base because of the way they contribute year over year. What about that?
So I think it's important to differentiate here, but I like the way you phrased that. I had not thought about driving people out of the tax base because usually you hear driving people out of state. And we did some research on this, and because we're not the first state to try something like this, a tax on high earners, and it does seem to drive some people out of state, but not as many as you might fear, and that's not the big problem. But what it really does is drive dollars out of our tax base. So it encourages people to hide more of their money or structure their finances in a way so that they earn just under $1 million in a given year. And one thing you have to keep in mind here, a tax that is targeted at 26,000 households earning over $1 million is a tax targeted at some very well-resourced households, right? These are households in a strong position to hire tax attorneys, to hire accountants, to think about how to minimize their taxes. And that's one reason to expect they're going to successfully find ways to minimize their taxes.
So in your analysis estimates about $1.3 billion of value could come from saying yes to question one. Per year, thank you. In your analysis, did you calculate what the offsetting dollars that might flow out because 26,000 households have good access to resources to take their money out of the tax base?
Yeah, we did. That's how we ended up at 1.3.
So that includes those withdrawals.
It does. If you leave that out, you have a number closer to $2.1 billion. If you assume that nobody changes their behaviors in any way.
Yep.
But about a third of that money, we estimate, you know, based on prior research, goes away, a third of that revenue goes away once you account for the fact that people are going to change their behaviors. Principally, they're going to try to find ways to avoid paying the tax.
Okay, so last intended or unintended consequence. There are critics who say this is a backdoor. It's a stalking horse. Massachusetts has a flat tax. This would be the beginning of graduating that tax, meaning the more you earn, the more you pay.
I don't see any basis for this concern. It has been really hard for the yes folks to get to this point. This ballot question was supposed to come up 4 years ago. It got blocked. It's taken another 4 years to get here. It's a change to the Constitution. There's no way to create a graduated tax from this without another change to the Constitution. So, no, I mean, I think there are plenty of reasons to support and oppose this, legitimate reasons, and that one's nowhere doesn't make my list.
And to underscore that, State Senator Jason Lewis, who co-sponsored the legislation that put question one on the ballot, told the Boston Globe, quote, "This is not a back door. This is not a cracked door. The door is still deadbolted shut on a graduated tax," unquote. And you're saying, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, unless voters change their mind. Like, there's no way legislators can just turn around to make it happen. It would require the same kind of process. So, no, I don't see it happening in the near term.
Okay, and ultimately, how would you characterize the overall impact of the measure if it passes?
I guess I've been saying kind of meaningful but not transformative. That is, $1.3 billion is a lot of money. And if it's well targeted, it can do a lot of good on issues that people really care about, issues of educational attainment, issues of racial equity, issues around fixing our transit system. We all see what's going on with the T. So the targeting matters a lot. What's implausible is fixing all these things with $1 billion. That is, oh, we'll fix education and the T and all the bridges and, you know, all the roads. And no, that's not enough money for that. I mean, the state budget is something like $40 to $50 billion a year. So we're talking about 2-3% increase. So a meaningful amount of money that will make a difference in people's lives if well targeted, but not a transformative amount of money.
That was Evan Horowitz, Executive Director of the Center for State Policy Analysis. So now that we've broken it down, we'll hear from both sides of question one in a live debate co-sponsored by WBUR, the Boston Globe, and WCVB on Radio Boston tomorrow at 11. Say hello, Tiffany.
Hi, Tiziana. How are you?
I'm great. Tiffany Faison here in Studio 2 with us. As you know, Food Network star, entrepreneur, female pioneer, and friend of the show. Great to have you back.
So nice to be back. Thanks for having me again.
So listen, we are getting what my father would have called emotionally involved with you as we get to know you better on the show. And I think you have some news for us today, and I do not know what it is. So
you don't know?
Tell us. I don't really know.
You sort of know.
I have a little bit of an idea, but the embargoed release we usually get that your team is like, no way.
Yeah.
we didn't get. So tell us.
We're careful about how we talk about things. So as many people know, I shuttered Tiger. Last year.
Tiger Mama.
And wanted to do a new concept and wanted to kind of bring something else to the neighborhood. And so we are ready to talk about what it is that
this
we're
doing.
This
is my drum roll.
Yep.
Tell us.
We'll be opening in November. I'm bringing a giant tenderonis to Fenway.
So, wow.
Yeah. We, when I opened High Street, I put in three new concepts, Bubble Bath, Dive Bar, and Tenderonis. And for me, Tenderonis just has like incredible legs. It just that as a brand and a concept, I'm really excited about it.
For those who don't know, and Grinders.
It's pizza. Well, it's not going to be Grinders in Fenway. It'll be different than it is in High Street. We will still have the pizzas. They're 2.5 feet long. Burnt parm edges on all of them. Really fun toppings. A lot of the pizzas that you'll see at Fenway will be represented at the High Street location. But there will be so much more. And it's going to be... I'm so excited about this. So it is going to be wild. Like it's, I don't always live in more is more with restaurants. Like sometimes I think subtlety is important, but I'm living in more is more. Like this.
Why?
Is,
so why more is more at this moment? Why with tenderonis?
Yep.
Like why?
I want it to be fun. We're in a really interesting time in restaurants, and I think it's very hard to have fun in restaurants right now. We're understaffed. The prices on things, our costs are so high. I'm watching a bunch of my colleagues and other restaurateurs just struggle. And I mean, every time I have a conversation with someone, people are pulling their hair out and they're exasperated. And I just thought it is time to have fun again. And we have a ball at Sweet Cheeks. And I thought let's do this in some way, and let's bring that level of joy and fun and exuberance and like unabashed just bling. And it's gonna be essentially like it's gonna look like a tricked out roller rink. I mean, we're talking like disco balls and lots of stuff from like the 70s and 80s and lots of lights, like it's roller skates. And
it makes me think of Donkey Show, right? That
yes.
that ART production.
Yes, it's not unlike that, like just incredible colors, and every moment in the space is like a different moment. You can have different experiences in the space and really fun beverage program, and it's going to be Italian-ish, so pizza for sure. Some of the things that we loved from Orfano that we're bringing back over, giant mozzarella stick, meatballs, things like that, that are just unabashedly fun, big salads. So it's going to be a blast, and I couldn't be more excited.
So this gives us a chance to do a little bit of event then and now. All right. So we took a clip. This is from 2016 when First Look on NBC featured Tiger Mama.
Mm.
So tell me how the name Tiger Mama came.
You know, it's me in a lot of ways. Like, I want a lot from the people that work for us. I want them to learn a lot. I want a lot for their lives.
So okay. You a tough Tiger Mama?
I can be.
So that was so interesting when I heard the clip this morning after Andrea pulled it because, I mean, we've talked about your evolution, mm-hmm. right? So 6 years later, nobody doubts that you're a winner now because we've seen you win.
Well, I still do.
And we've talked about that.
I'm glad you guys don't.
We've talked about actually that, right? That secret fear that maybe you're not and that need to prove it all the time. But it is really interesting to watch the world evolve and you evolve. And embrace at that moment what you wanted to do with Tiger Mama, mm-hmm. right? This is about learning. This is about drive.
Mm-hmm.
And today this is about fun. This is about joy.
Right. It's never not about learning and drive. It's never not about that. But I think as I evolve and grow into my own skin as a human, as a teacher, as a restaurateur, as a chef, I'm able to kind of understand how it can be all of those things. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I think there's something about being young in this that you're so afraid that, and I still am afraid that it's all going to go away. It feels like a house of cards all the time. But there's something about holding onto it with a death grip. That's like, if we're not, exceeding everyone's expectations every second of the day and doing things that no one has ever seen and blah, blah, and just, like, you feel this pressure to, like, you know, and then get the best review possible from the Boston Globe. Blah, blah, and, like, just, like, I can't live in that anymore. You know, like, we can live in learning and excelling and making people happy. And is this the best version of what we're doing? And how do we make it better? How do we make it more efficient? How do we do something that brings in the best ingredients and allows us to be very proud of the things that we're doing, what we're making? And then at the same time, how do we meet our guests in a place where they're having fun and they're experiencing joy and all of the things that we are putting into the food, they're getting back from it, as opposed to it just us living on this edge of, if we're not excellent every second of the day, oh my God, we're gonna, you know, everything's gonna fall apart. So I think that's just the evolution of me as a chef and as a restaurateur. And that's not to say, you know, it's funny because, like, I even saying this, having this conversation with you right now, like, the young chef in me is like, get it together faster, more. Like, you know, I'm like, it's like hard for me to even say it's okay. And it's not slowing down, it's relaxing into ourselves and being confident in my own skin. And allowing those around me to do that too.
So two thoughts. But first, just to remind listeners, we're speaking with Tiffany Faison. She's back here with us in Studio 2, just letting us know that the Tiger Mama that she closed a year ago will become a magnificent disco-y expanded Tenderoni's next month.
Yes,
in November.
In November.
So two things occurred to me, and we'll do them one at a time. The first is, it struck me, both this morning and in listening to you now, that over time, one would have an opportunity, if one wanted, as an eater and a lover of food and a studier of Boston, to trace your evolution by going through your restaurants.
Hmm.
And is that true? Like, could I, as I'm getting to know you on air, right, go to, in no particular order here, Bubble Bath and Tenderoni and Dive Bar and Sweet Cheeks, and find a way to find your growth in the menus and the decor and the vibe and the people who work there?
Yeah. I mean, I think, yes, I would be remiss to start you at my restaurants. I think we would have to kind of back up a little bit and understand where I really started in Boston. And it was, you know, for Todd English in 2001, right after September 11th, and at Bonfire, and then working for Todd for a while, and working for Tony Maz at Craigie Street, opening the original Craigie Street, and Pagal for a minute, and then coming back to Boston to work at Oya. And I think I would, you would have to kind of see the landscape of all of it, and then to kind of understand where, you know, starting at Roca and having that be my first gig as, like, as an executive chef in the city, and feeling like everything was so consequential every second of every day. Mm. And then, yes, being able to kind of see the evolution of relaxing into myself and understanding not only who I am, but who, what I want for this city and what I would like to, I don't want to say legacy, that's like a dumb, I'm way too young and that you can never know what your legacy is, but what my wish for this city would be. And it is always excellent food and incredible service and technique that is unparalleled. And it is still all of those things I wanted as a young chef, but it is also the ability for us to let our hair down and have some fun. I always want that for this city. And I feel like if there's something that I can continue to do to just break through that wall where we just are able to be less self-conscious and have a good time and laugh a little too loud and have maybe one more drink than we should and leave not being able to wait to come back. That is what I want for my restaurants. I want people to leave their lives at the door and have a ball and not be able to pinpoint where they are, whether you're in Boston or whatever it is. And then, you know, that's what I want for the city. I want us to just be able to have a really good time. Sometimes I feel really jealous about that when I'm in other cities, that it feels like that level of self-consciousness leaves. And I want that for us.
I'm sitting with that because I hadn't really thought about how hard it can be here to just relax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the drive for excellence, the drive to prove, mm-hmm. the drive to be the best is a part of who we are.
100%. We have the best schools, the best hospitals, the best institute. Like, we are the best of the best of the best. And at some point, we have to relax.
So that brings me to the other thing I was going to. And by the way, there were like 20 things we were going to. We're not going to talk about any of them because this is fascinating. And I just want to stay here. Somebody said to me once, a mentor said to me once, you know, we each have some trait that we hold tight to ourselves mm-hmm. because we believe it got us where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And then there comes a time in our lives where that thing that got us where we are will keep us from getting to the next place. And you have to let it go.
Yep.
And when I heard you say, the young chef in me, mm-hmm. right, is saying, wait, wait, you got to push, you got to push. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh my God, is this that moment?
100%.
Interesting.
100%. And it's not just the holding on to the precious and the... And I want to be very clear. Again, this is, you know, it's we're clearly in a therapy session right now because I feel like I have to make up for the things that I'm saying. Where it's like, no, we're still excellent. We're still, I don't have to, like, let that go. I don't have to prove that anymore. We are still excellent. Our food is excellent. Our service is excellent. But it can be excellent in a different way. And it can be convivial and joyful and fun and not so buttoned up and not so stiff and rigid. And so, yes, the thing that got the relentless push for excellence and really the finer point of technique in every little thing that got me here and the inability to let it go and let other people excel and to not trust other people, that has to go. It has to go. And that's been a lesson that I've learned over the course of, I think, probably the last 4 years more than anything else. Changing business partners and changing in the last few years of the pandemic, it's never just been me. And so the thought process that it is me and I can control and I can hold and I can, yes, I lead, but I can only lead through allowing other people to be who they are and bring what they bring to the table and do it together. And so this idea that I'm going to hold on to something so tight, I mean, it's Lenny and the rabbit, right? Like at some point...
Yeah.
I'm going to suffocate everything if I don't let it go and let everyone else not only have a piece of it, but allow themselves to be seen in all of it. It can't just be me.
So Lenny and the Rabbit is the thing I'm still going to be thinking about later today. I'm just going to say that now. All right. So I do want to have fun for a minute, but I'm just going to note later, I'm going to go back and listen to this, and I'm going to map out that restaurant crawl.
Woo!
I think that'd be fun to do
all right.
at some point.
All right.
All right. So do you want to have just like a minute of fun with
of
me?
Of course. Just 1 minute. Not more than that.
No,
I can't handle
no more
one
fun
more,
allowed.
More than a minute of fun.
No more fun allowed. Fall.
Yeah.
Last year, we sort of set up. Is it pumpkins or is it apples? And it was a bit of a throwdown
Oof.
On our show. Is it pumpkins or apples?
I reject the choice. I reject that I have to choose one or the other.
You love them both.
Why can't we love everything equally?
All right. Fair enough.
You know, you can't take a bite out of a pumpkin, but you can't carve an apple.
Excellent. There you go. All right. And my last question. So I discovered late... that if one professes out loud that one likes candy corn, one gets destroyed for that, which I have been destroyed a number of times. I like candy corn. So do you like candy corn?
I like candy, period. I'm a sugar addict. I wish I wasn't. Candy corn is not my favorite.
Oh, no.
No, I don't think. But I also don't live in the shaming people for stuff. Like, there's things I don't get. I don't get peeps. And also, the peeps
year
round, what are we doing? Stop. Just can we just deal with them once a year, please? Now there's like peeps for everything. You know, live your life. Eat candy corn. I don't know. I don't want people coming for me for like raiding the 7-Eleven hot dog bar. So leave me alone. I'll leave you alone. We're all going to be fine.
The 7-Eleven hot dog bar makes me feel better about my candy corn. All right. Boston culinary star, restaurateur, entrepreneur, strong woman, friend of the show, and launcher of a new restaurant.
Tenderoni's.
Next month in Fenway. Tenderoni's. This has been Tiffany Faison. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Cambridge author Celeste Ng catapulted to celebrity author status with her second book, Little Fires Everywhere. That's now a limited series on Hulu starring Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington. And after 6 years of writing, Ng has released her latest novel. It came out October 4th. It's called Our Missing Hearts and takes readers to a dystopian world that feels eerily possible and also close to home. Celeste joined us in the studio to talk about the book, and I asked her how she's feeling just a few days after Our Missing Hearts was released.
I'm feeling all of the feelings right now. I feel really fortunate to actually get to go out and talk to readers about the book, meet them. That's a really special experience. It's also always a little scary to put a book out into the world. You don't know whether it's going to connect with readers. And so the response so far has been really wonderful.
What do you love most about getting to meet your readers?
Well, when you're writing a book, you're kind of by yourself, and you don't know if the things that you're writing about are things that other people will care about. You don't know if the things that you're writing will even be interesting to other people. And so it's really meaningful to get to go out and meet readers and have them say to me, this book explains something to me about my life or my family, or this book made me ask questions. That's maybe the nicest thing that a writer can hear. The sense that what you were writing actually meant something to somebody else, that's a really fantastic thing to hear.
So this new book, Our Missing Hearts, we'll dive into it in a second, but I have to ask you, what are you hearing from readers about it already as you meet them?
A lot of them are saying that it's very moving, especially people who have children or who've been involved in raising children. A lot of them are saying that it's making them think about the world that we live in today and what the parallels are between the world in the book and the world that we're living in and what they can do about it. And that's been a fantastic piece of feedback.
And the two main voices are a 12-year-old boy and his mother, who are separated by many plot lines in the book, but, you know, there is a mother and a child who are the prime voices here. I thought maybe what I would try is to tell you at the simplest level what I think the book is about for our listeners, and then you can tell me if I basically got it.
Okay.
Okay. So this is a story at its heart of a family. The son is separated by distance. His mother is in hiding. Because they live in a world in which there's been an economic collapse, and coming out of it, the U.S. has decided that China is the scapegoat, and it takes two steps. One is virulent anti-Chinese sentiment, which turns into a culture of anti-Asian sentiment in the country, and a fascist-like set of policies, including child removal for people who too vociferously disagree with the government. And it takes place, wait for it, basically in Harvard Square for a lot of the story. How'd I do?
Pretty well. I feel like that's a really good summary of the situation in the book. And that's exactly the world that Bird, who's the 12-year-old protagonist of the novel, finds himself in at the very beginning. And part of the book is about him trying to reconnect with his mother, to find his mother and understand why she left him. And that's also the story of him trying to understand the world that he's living in and how it came to be that way, and maybe how he can try and make it better.
So, you know, as I'm reading the book, and I had crashes of thoughts, oh, I want to talk to her about this, and I want to talk to her about that. So the first one is, so you started writing this book in 2016. So much of the hate in the book feels like it resonates with the COVID era, both, you know, the hate crimes and the acts of hate against undifferentiated members of the Asian and Asian American community in Boston, right, during that time. But I wonder, was this a prediction in 2016, or were you stunned when COVID comes along and now so much of what you had already started writing feels like it's playing out in our streets here?
Well, I think that as a Chinese American woman, I think that I've always been aware that this kind of violence was out there. I've seen some of it happen. I think that for most Asian Americans and really most people of color, you know the feeling that at any moment a situation could turn and someone could suddenly look at you and go, you don't belong here. What are you doing here? And so when COVID hit, and we started to see all of the increase in attacks on Asian Americans, I wasn't exactly surprised. It was sort of an escalation of something that I think I'd been aware of. What was horrifying to me was seeing how out in the open it was, how some of these attacks, many of the attacks, were in the middle of the day. They were on elderly people often. And most horrifying to me was that sometimes people would just watch them happen. A lot of them got caught on videotape, and bystanders would just sort of walk by. And that was a lot of the feeling that I wanted to explore, especially in the second half of the novel, is what do we do in a situation like that? You know, when can you just walk away and say, well, that's somebody else's problem, and when does it become an us problem?
So, and I'll issue a blanket spoiler alert from this moment forward for listeners in our conversation. There is a moment in the second half of the book when Bird finds himself in New York. Mm-hmm. He looks across the street and sees a woman that he thinks might be his mother and very quickly figures out that's not my mom. But his hunger to see her makes him think it's her for a moment. And he's describing her and she's walking a dog, and out of nowhere, a man bludgeons her, just beats her to the ground, kicks her, and then kills the dog. And nobody does anything. Bird screams, the man looks at him, Bird runs off. Let me tell you why I'm bringing that up. Not only does it resonate with the things that you just said, but here's what I found myself thinking. In Boston, I could imagine people writing that off. Oh, that's New York, right? That's one of those New York stories. She wrote that in New York. I feel like the book is saying that could have been Harvard Square, not New York. And would people have been able to tolerate it here if you had told that story about us?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, one reason that I wanted to set the story in Cambridge, as you said, a lot of it takes place right around Harvard Square, partly because I live here. It's a world that I know. It's a world that I, you know, felt that I could describe. But partly it's also the world has this perception of Boston, Cambridge in particular, Harvard even more so, of being this liberal bubble where nothing bad ever happens. I think we have that impression of ourselves as well. We'd like to think that. But the truth is that racism is everywhere, and this kind of anti-Asian sentiment happens everywhere. And, you know, I've walked in my own neighborhood in Cambridge. I'm, you know, running an errand. I'm walking with my kid home from school. And I've had the experience of people leaning out their windows and just shouting slurs at me. And I think many people are horrified and surprised to hear that. And many other people are like, yeah, that's how it happens. The truth is that we're not better off than anywhere else is.
So in the things that were banging around in my head that I wanted to talk to you about with this book, another was a conversation that I had with Margaret Atwood in 2020. So she had produced the sequel to The Handmaid's Tale. It was called The Testaments. And it also takes place in Cambridge in Harvard Square. And I asked her about that choice, and she said something really specific about why she did that made me think of you.
It would be very unlikely, you would think, but then you look back at Germany and see how quickly, once Hitler had got his hand on the levers of power, how quickly he turned it. So it was a bit of a warning. You think it can't happen here, and then it happens.
And I want to add to that, not to be political, but to underscore that you think and then it does and you think it can't. Interestingly, after the Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade, she made some statements, but also posted a photo of herself holding a mug that said, "I told you so." And is there an "I told you so," given that you started this book in 2016 and it's 2022 now, is there an "I told you so" in this book?
I wouldn't put it as an "I told you so." I think I would put it as, okay, so now you know. What are we going to do about it? Because I don't want to give the impression at all that I was ahead of the curve on any of these things, that I knew better than anybody else did. For me, it's more, this is an experience that I already had. And I think for so many Asians, but also for just people of color generally, if you've had that experience, you know. And if you haven't had it, you don't know. And the real question for me is not, well, why didn't you know before? But now that you do know, what will you do about it?
So that's interesting, because it also feels not only like the question that you're asking the readers, but it feels like the question that the characters are asking themselves.
Yes.
One of the things that happens, I had never felt like I really understood or connected with protest art until I read this book. And there are several guerrilla art installations, ice sculptures and yarn on trees and ping pong balls with messages, all of which are done quietly and then disappear quickly or are erased by law enforcement quickly. And as they happen, they're designed, and this is where we'll come back to, you know, our missing hearts as a thread, that phrase is a thread through them, to help raise awareness that many more children are being taken from their homes and, quote unquote, resettled, right, with more appropriate families. And it raises this awareness. And it feels like the characters, one by one, are confronted with, okay, now you know. So what are you going to do? What was it like to ask yourself in your own imagination, well, what would I do, so that you could write it into the choices the characters then make?
I'm so glad you said that, because that was the question that I was asking myself. And one of my writer friends has a saying. They say, give the problem of your novel to your novel. And what they mean by that is whatever you feel like you're wrestling with in the writing process, a lot of times that's a question that your characters need to answer in the pages of the novel as well. And so when I started writing this novel, I was looking back at periods of history in which free expression and free speech were really being curtailed, in which groups were being discriminated against, in which the government was really authoritarian. And one of the things that struck me was how much I had not known. I had known about some of these things. I had known about Japanese internment, for example, during World War II, when Japanese Americans and, you know, American-born, you know, citizens of Japanese descent were incarcerated in the desert. I had known about that, but I realized that a lot of people had not. And I learned a lot about other things that I was sort of embarrassed to not have known more about. I knew, for example, about the so-called boarding schools, the residential schools that Native American children were sent to, but I hadn't known how horrific they were. And part of that feeling is guilt. And part of that, again, I think is the question you pointed out. What are you going to do about it now that you do know? And I think that's a question we're wrestling with now.
So the U.S. Department of the Interior had a report in May, just to underscore what you just said, that found there were 408 boarding schools for indigenous children between 1819 and 1969, where children suffered forced cultural assimilation and physical abuse. And so far, they know of more than 500 children who died, to kind of underscore the realities of what you're talking about. All right, so I'm going to ask you now to read a little bit from the story. We've picked a little selection. I'll ask you to read it, and then if there's any context you want to provide around it. But this is Bird.
Sure. This is a little section where Bird, whose birth name is Noah, but he goes by the nickname Bird. He's about to have an experience. At first, it had been just a phrase, like any other. Not long after his mother left, Bird had found a slip of paper on the bus, thin as a dead butterfly's wing, in the gap between seat and wall. One of dozens. His father snatched it from his hand and crumpled it, tossed it to the floor. "Don't pick up garbage, Noah," he said. But Bird had already read the words at the top, "All our missing hearts." A phrase he'd never heard before, but that sprang up elsewhere in the months, then years, after his mother had gone. Graffitied in the bike tunnel, on the wall of the basketball court, on the plywood around a long-stalled construction site, "Don't forget our missing hearts."
A line from a poetry book of hers that gets pulled into the movement and eventually drives her into hiding, really to protect him.
Yeah.
And the first part of the book is in Bird's voice. We get into the second part, and now we're in Margaret's voice, his mother. And as a mother, I'm going to get a little emotional here, as a mother of a teenage boy, I thought, oh, no, 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 no. Do not make me go into the head of the mother here and live this through her. Your boy is Bird's age. What did it cost you to put yourself in the mind of the mother?
Yeah, when I started this novel, my son was quite young, and it took me so long to finish the novel, honestly, that he's almost caught up to Bird's age now. It was really difficult because I think, you know, one of the worst things that a parent can imagine is being separated from their child or having to be separated from their child. And writing this book was sort of an exercise in imagining what would I do? What would I take on? You know, what would have to make it worth it, so to speak, for me to leave my child behind? And that is a really difficult question. I think I would like to think, of course, I would live by my principles. I would stand up for the things that I believe are right. I'd do whatever was necessary. That calculation gets really complicated and really difficult when your family, the people that you love most, might be put in danger. And that is the question that Margaret, Bird's mother, is asking herself in the second part of the book.
When I had to provide like a one-sentence summary for the story, I said, well, it's about hate and it's about fascism and it's about trust in each other. Is that right?
I think that's right, and I'm so glad that you pointed out the trust part. For me, it is about finding trust in community and hope in the face of hate and fear and everything else. It really came out of me asking myself questions during the Trump years and then during the pandemic of how do I raise a child in this kind of world? How am I supposed to tell him, okay, we're working on this. It's going to get better. How do I hold on to hope in the face of all of this? I think a lot of people have been asking themselves those questions. And so although the book does go into a dark world, for me, it is about Bird learning to find hope again and to find connection to his mother, to other people, to the values that his family has been trying to hold on to despite everything.
Has this book changed you writing it? And if so, how?
I think it has. It's cheating a little bit to say that every book changes me, I guess. But this one has made me ask a lot of questions to myself about how you live values versus just how you maybe speak about them, what the difference is between acting on those values and just sort of espousing them. I think we often talk to our children and we tell them how we think they should be. But one thing that I'm learning, especially as my child gets older, is that they watch you as well, right? And a lot of times the moments that you don't think that they're paying attention are the moments that make a huge impression on them. And so it really has made me think a lot about the ways that I show him how I try to live as the kind of person that I'm trying to teach him to be.
So you said the book asks readers, now you know, what do you do about it? What do you want readers to do?
I think I want people to notice, to pay attention, to not be complacent when they see things happening that they know are wrong. That sounds like such an easy thing to do, but it can be really hard. In the moment, you often are startled and you don't know what to do, but having been in situations where I've dealt with harassment or violence on both sides, I know that it makes a difference when people are not bystanders or when bystanders step in. There was a time years ago, I remember, I was on the T and there was a woman wearing hijab and a man started harassing her and just saying all kinds of vile things to her. And it was just the three of us on the train and the conductor. And the conductor was aware of the situation and was getting to the next stop and had called the police. But in the meantime, I didn't know what to do for this woman. And so I just looked at her and I just started talking to her about the weather and looking at the guy and rolling my eyes. And I hope that made a difference to her. I know that when I've been in situations like that and someone has stepped in, it made a huge difference to me to just have someone else say, I see what's happening here. You're not alone. You're not wrong in thinking this is wrong. I see it too. And so if readers, after thinking about this book, have in the back of their mind, oh, I can make a difference. Even just talking to someone, even stepping in a small way can make a difference. I think that would be a good thing. I would be happy with that.
Celeste Ng is the author of three books. Her latest is Our Missing Hearts, and it's out now. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. We had help today from Michaela Varela. Titus Follodoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston, where we will bring you a debate on ballot question one.